Hello, dear A Minder listener. I hope you're having a wonderful day today and are ready for the next half an hour, however long it takes to get through these 19 papers on epidemiological studies and risk factors of Alzheimer's disease. My name is Nyla, and I'm your host today to take you through the latest papers that were published in February 2022, ranging from epidemiological studies, papers on ethnic and racial disparities, social determinants, and lifestyle and environmental factors related to dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Before we get started, a quick intro to our podcast.
Welcome to A Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
So, as you might already know, if you've been listening to A Minder for a while, what we do on this podcast is that we look through PubMed every month for new peer-reviewed literature on Alzheimer's disease. We sort our papers into a variety of categories, and then we deliver these in audio form. So what we're doing is summarizing based on the abstracts. We do not take a deep dive or any kind of critical lens on these papers. So if you'd like to do that yourself, we encourage you to follow up on them by finding them in the attached bibliography. I'll be giving you all the information throughout and numbering the papers so they're easy to track. With that, let's get started with some papers on epidemiological studies more broadly. So these are ones looking kind of generally at the prevalence and incidence of dementia in various populations. So first up is a paper by first author Riedel and last author Langner from Leibniz Institute for Prevention Research and Epidemiology, in Bremen, Germany. It was published in Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety. Oh my gosh, the number of times I have to say that word in this episode. And the title of paper number one is Stability of Individual Dementia Diagnoses in Routine Care: Implications for Epidemiological Studies. So in this study, the authors set out to determine how stable an individual's dementia diagnosis is over time. That is to say, if they were initially diagnosed with vascular dementia, for example, is this likely to be re-diagnosed as Alzheimer's or another form of dementia as the disease progresses? This question is important for epidemiological studies, as these often rely on medical records of dementia diagnoses and often compare the risk factors or prevalence of different dementia subtypes. The authors used German health claims data to identify over 160,000 patients aged 50 and older who had dementia at baseline. Participants were categorized as having Alzheimer's dementia, vascular dementia, or other forms of dementia based on ICD-10 codes. Any changes in categories were noted during a 4-year follow-up period. Most patients' initial diagnosis did remain consistent over the study period, and some were only diagnosed at baseline, so there's no comparison to make. But when there was a change in diagnosis, this occurred most frequently in participants who had initially received an Alzheimer's diagnosis. Among Alzheimer's disease patients, the diagnosis was more likely to be stable AD, that is Alzheimer's, in younger patients and in those who had less inpatient days. The authors conclude that there is a substantial number of changes in diagnoses as dementia progresses, especially for Alzheimer's, and this needs to be taken into consideration when interpreting epidemiological data on different dementia subtypes. Next up, we have a methods-focused paper, which looked at the well-established sex difference in AD from a big data lens to further our understanding of what factors might underlie this difference and how it influences disease prevalence and progression in men and women. Paper 2 is published in Nature Communications by first author Tang and last author Sirota, primarily from UCSF in San Francisco, And the title is Deep Phenotyping of Alzheimer's Disease Leveraging Electronic Medical Records Identifies Sex-Specific Clinical Associations. The authors used two independent electronic medical record systems totaling over 44,000 patients to conduct a network analysis and deep clinical phenotyping. Essentially, they wanted to determine the clinical characteristics and sex-specific clinical associations in Alzheimer's. They report that patients had greater comorbidity interactions than matched controls, but you'll need to check the paper for details. Overall, their data-driven method of phenotyping could help predict what clinical factors ought to be followed carefully for diagnostic and prognostic purposes, and what these may tell us about underlying mechanisms and therapeutic avenues for AD. Next up, we have paper number 3, which is entitled Identification of Cognitively Impaired Patients at Risk for Development of Alzheimer's Disease Dementia, an analysis of U.S. Medicare claims data. This is from Biogen in Cambridge, USA, and from Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, by first author Potashman and last author Stefanacci, and it was published in Expert Review of Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research. In this paper, the authors assess what factors might predict the transition from mild cognitive impairment, that is MCI, to AD or to dementia due to any cause, that is all-cause dementia. They found that the main predictors of receiving an AD dementia diagnosis included age and the use of antipsychotics or hypertension medication. Interestingly, tracking medication use for comorbid conditions, that is, for health conditions that occur in tandem with Alzheimer's disease, or the disease of interest, was more reliable in determining dementia risk than tracking the comorbidity coding itself. The authors also report on some potentially protective factors, including the use of anxiolytics, inpatient status at time of diagnosis, and a history of stroke. You'll have to check the paper for why this might be. Overall, better understanding of what factors influence a person's risk of progressing from MCI to dementia may improve system-level planning to prepare or to better prepare patients, families, and clinicians for this eventuality. Moving on to paper number 4, which is entitled Longitudinal Associations of Mental Disorders with Dementia, 30-year analysis of 1.7 million New Zealand citizens. This is by first author Richmond Rackard and last author Moffitt, and it's from universities across the US, New Zealand, England, and Norway, and was published in JAMA Psychiatry. The authors set out to determine which psychiatric conditions increase dementia risk, as these could act as a modifiable risk factor if treated early enough. Although this has been studied before, more longitudinal data is needed to be able to draw links between conditions or events in early life and the development of dementia in late life. Here, the authors examined the relationship between three psychiatric disorders and dementia risk over 3 decades of observation, using data from people born in New Zealand in the mid-1900s and who resided in the country for any time during the 30-year observation period. They determined the diagnosis of psychiatric disorders and dementia diagnoses from public records, and their study sample was around 1.7 million people, half of which were male and who ranged from age 21 to 60 at baseline. The authors found that the risk of developing dementia was higher in individuals who had a psychiatric disorder compared to those who didn't. The presence of a mental disorder also led to an earlier diagnosis amongst those with dementia by a mean of nearly 6 years. These associations remained even after accounting for pre-existing chronic physical diseases and socioeconomic deprivation. Check the paper for details on which disorders the authors looked at, but overall, these findings suggest that ameliorating treatment for psychiatric conditions earlier in life could help reduce dementia risk or disease progression later on. This next paper is actually not about a risk factor of Alzheimer's, but rather how Alzheimer's and other dementias can act as a risk factor themselves. Specifically, we're looking at whether behaviors linked to Alzheimer's and dementia might result in incarceration. This was published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society by first author Cuffell and last author Barry, from the San Francisco Veterans Healthcare System, the Northern California Institute of Research and Education, and University of Connecticut. And the title of paper 5 is Prevalence of Dementia and Mild Cognitive Impairment Before Incarceration. So usually this type of study does not make it into our episodes, as it doesn't really match our inclusion criteria. But considering it slipped by our sorting process, I think it warrants a quick summary. Basically, the authors looked at nearly 18,000 cases in which Medicare-eligible U.S. veterans had transitioned from incarceration to the community in mid to late life, after having been incarcerated for 10 or more consecutive years. The authors used medical claims data to verify dementia and mild cognitive impairment diagnoses in the 3 years leading up to incarceration, and found that about 3% of their study sample had dementia or MCI in this time window. Of more direct relevance to this episode, compared to participants with no diagnosis, those with either MCI or dementia were more likely to be non-Hispanic whites, to have more medical and psychiatric comorbidities, and to experience homelessness and traumatic brain injury at higher rates. And the association with traumatic brain injury is actually something that I cover as well in these episodes. Unfortunately, today's episode, I could not cover all of the papers, so you'll find 2 papers on traumatic brain injury in the accompanying bibliography as well in part 2. But just to conclude this paper, suffice it to say that cognitive impairment ought to be considered seriously as a factor contributing to incarceration. That brings us to our next section on ethnic and racial disparities. So we're looking at how these might factor into the risk of AD and what some of the underlying reasons may be for this. And for this section, please note that I always use the ethnic and racial group terms that are used in the abstract for consistency. So first up, we have paper number 6, entitled The Link Between APOE4 Presence and Neuropsychological Test Performance Among Mexican Americans and Non-Hispanic Whites of the Multi-Ethnic Health Aging Brain Study Health Disparities Cohort. This was published by first author O'Brien and last author Rissman and the HABS HD study team, primarily at the University of North Texas and the University of California, and it was published in Dementia and Geriatric Cognitive Disorders. So apolipoprotein 4, or APOE4, is the strongest genetic risk factor linked to Alzheimer's, and it's possible that a higher occurrence or different effects of this genetic variant in certain racial and ethnic groups could be responsible for the increased risk of AD and cognitive impairment. In this study, the authors examined the link between the APOE4 allele and neuropsychological outcomes among 850 Mexican Americans, and 780 non-Hispanic whites acted as the comparison group. While the authors found that both the APOE4 and E2 alleles were significantly lower among Mexican Americans, there was a difference in how the E4 allele affected cognitive functioning. In Mexican Americans, this genetic risk factor was associated with worse immediate and delayed memory, whereas in non-Hispanic whites, it was additionally associated with worse executive function and verbal fluency. This suggests that the effects of the APOE4 allele on cognition are more widespread in non-Hispanic whites than in Mexican Americans. If you'd like to hear more about APOE and other genetic risk factors of AD, check out our previous episodes on the topic as well as this month's bibliography. Speaking of more research on the genetic underpinning of racial and ethnic differences in AD, we've got paper number 8. Entitled Race, Genetic Admixture, and Cognitive Performance in the Cuban Population. And this is coming from the Washington University in St. Louis by first author Libre Guerra and last author Libre Rodriguez. And it was published in the Journal of Gerontology, Series A, Biological Science and Medical Science. So, while there has been a lot of data to support a racial or ethnic disparity in dementia risk within the US, less research has been done in low and middle income countries. In this cross-sectional survey, the authors recruited nearly 3,000 older Cubans to identify the effects of self-identified race and genetic composition on cognitive performance. They found that the overall prevalence of dementia, as diagnosed based on DSM-4 criteria, was 8.7%, but they did not identify significant differences in the prevalence across self-identified race. This remained the case even after controlling for age, sex, and education and ancestry. So overall, there was no evidence of an independent effect of self-identified race and/or population ancestry on dementia prevalence nor on cognitive performance. The authors conclude that the differences observed in other studies may be primarily due to social determinants of health. We're back in the US for this next paper, coming from the University of Michigan and Columbia University, and having a look at whether social determinants of the racial disparity in AD risk could have direct biological consequences. So paper 8 is published in Social Science and Medicine by first author Zahodny and last author Brickman, and the title is Longitudinal Associations Between Racial Discrimination and Hippocampal and White Matter Hyperintensity Volumes Among Older Black Adults. The authors hypothesize that racial discrimination could contribute to the higher risk of Alzheimer's and related dementias in non-Hispanic Black older adults in the U.S., and they speculate whether this could be due to long-term effects on the brain. To answer this question, just over 200 non-Hispanic Black participants in the Washington Heights and Inwood Columbia Aging Project underwent two structural magnetic resonance imaging sessions, so that is MRI, at two different time points, and they completed various measures of discrimination, allowing the authors to examine aggregate experiences of discrimination, regardless of identity attributions, as well as racial discrimination specifically. When they looked at hippocampal and white matter hyperintensity volumes, which are two structural brain measures related to Alzheimer's, they found no difference in either based on aggregate experiences of discrimination. However, lifetime racial discrimination was associated with lower initial hippocampal volume, and everyday racial discrimination was related to a faster accumulation of white matter hyperintensity over time. So that suggests that racial discrimination specifically does have a detrimental effect on brain health in Black older adults, likely contributing to their increased dementia risk. And while we're on the topic of imaging studies and dementia risk in racial or ethnic minorities, I want to give a quick mention to this new publication from the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, or the ADNI, which I cover consistently throughout my episodes. So paper 9 is called Screening and Enrollment of Underrepresented Ethnocultural and Educational Populations in the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative. It's by first author Ashford and last author Weiner from a couple universities in California, and it was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia. The authors wanted to verify the ethnocultural and socioeconomic composition of Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative participants to make sure that the data resulting from this large and ongoing study is generalizable to diverse populations. They found that of just over 3,700 individuals that were screened for the study, 11% identified as being ethnoculturally underrepresented populations, and 16% had lower than 12 years of education. Similar percentages were observed in the nearly 2,300 individuals who were then enrolled in the study. The authors remarked that the participation of these populations is therefore lower compared to the numbers in the general population, meaning that caution should be taken in generalizing the ADNI results to ethnoculturally diverse and low education populations. And it's also important to mention that education levels, or specifically lower socioeconomic status and education, is linked to higher prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. It's thought that higher education or more cognitive stimulation throughout life can increase cognitive reserve and can protect against some of the structural brain and vascular changes in dementia. Anyway, that's a topic for another time, but just a note that we need to be careful, especially when it comes to questions of ethnic minorities, the intersections with socioeconomic status, and what that means for Alzheimer's disease risk. Next up, we have a paper on subjective cognitive decline, which can be a precursor to Alzheimer's disease, and how this relates to social determinants of health. We're still looking at racial and ethnic disparities here, as well as gender differences. So paper number 10 is entitled Gender and Racial Ethnic Disparities in Social Determinants of Health and Subjective Cognitive Decline, The Mediating Role of Depression, by first author Brown and last author Cohen, and is published in the Journal of Gerontology and Nursing. The authors use cross-sectional data from 6,500 participants aged 45 years and older. They wanted to determine the relationship between the participants' social determinants of health index, depression, and subjective cognitive decline. You'll have to check the paper for how depression was measured here. The authors found that social determinants of health were positively associated with subjective cognitive decline. This was true in the overall population, as well as men specifically and in white populations specifically. That was after controlling for gender, age, income, education, employment, and other health-related behaviors. These social determinants also associated with depression, which was in turn associated with subjective cognitive decline in men, women, and white and black populations. There are more details in the paper about how all of these associations are linked and how they differ between groups. But overall, the results suggest that there are both gender and racial/ethnic disparities in the relationship between social determinants of health, depression, and subjective cognitive decline. And let's focus in specifically on depression for this next paper, as there does seem to be a link to increased risk of cognitive impairment and dementia, and it may also differ between racial and ethnic groups. So paper 11 is published in Alzheimer's and Dementia by first author Babulal and last author Trani from Washington University in St. Louis and the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. And the title is The Complex Relationship Between Depression and Progression to Incident Cognitive Impairment Across Race and Ethnicity. Here, the authors look at cognitively normal older adults in five ethno-racial groups to see whether baseline differences in depression and in antidepressant use could predict progression to incident cognitive impairment. They used data from the National Alzheimer's Coordinating Center, totaling nearly 8,200 participants, including non-Hispanic whites, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and American Indians, as well as Alaskan Natives. They found that at baseline, African Americans had a lower risk of depression as compared to non-Hispanic whites, and there were no statistical interactions between ethno-racial groups and depression. That said, overall, depression did predict a faster progression to incident cognitive impairment, and both Hispanic and Asian participants were at higher risk of progressing to cognitive impairment compared to non-Hispanic white participants. The authors conclude that they did not find the previously reported link between depression and dementia in African American and non-Hispanic white participants, but that there are ethno-racial differences in how depression may relate to cognitive decline. For these next papers, we'll move away from racial and ethnic disparities, but we will stay in the theme of depression to look at a closely related phenomenon, that is, social isolation and loneliness. But before we tackle that topic, let's take a quick break as we're already halfway through our episode. I'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ellen Rowe, host and co-founder here at Aminder. I've been with the team since the very beginning in 2020, and I really love it because it's an outlet to hone my own science communication skills, and I feel super passionate about the mission of making sure scientists are well informed about all of the new research being churned out. It's also super rewarding to be a part of a community of like-minded and driven scientists from all career stages. If you're interested in getting involved with our team, we are currently recruiting new hosts and content creators for the show. This is a great opportunity for researchers interested in keeping up to date with the latest Alzheimer's research and getting some science communication experience in the process. If this has piqued your interest, you can reach us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com or through any of our social media platforms, and we'd love to hear a bit about you.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration in Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Okay, so we're going to jump into three papers on social determinants of dementia risk. And as I was mentioning before the break, this next paper explores social isolation and loneliness, which have both been associated with increased risk of dementia, and unfortunately often occur when elderly people get moved to care homes, or when there's a global pandemic that makes isolation all the more prevalent. So for paper 12, we're with first author Elovainio and last author Hakulinen. This is from the University of Helsinki and the Finnish Institute of Health and Welfare in Finland, and it was published in BMJ Open. Oh, and the title is Association of Social Isolation, Loneliness and Genetic Risk with Incidence of Dementia, UK Biobank Cohort Study. The authors wanted to parse out whether the association between social isolation, loneliness, and dementia is modified by the genetic risk of Alzheimer's, or whether it acts as a confounding variable. To test this, they studied over 155,000 participants who self-reported social isolation and loneliness, and evaluated genetic risk based on the polygenic risk score for AD. Incidence of dementia was determined using electronic health records. The authors report that 8.6% of their study sample reported being socially isolated, and 5.5% reported being lonely. In a mean follow-up of nearly 9 years, social isolation was associated with an increased risk of a dementia diagnosis, which occurred in about 1% of the study sample. There was no association between loneliness and dementia risk, and no interaction effects between genetic risk and either social isolation or loneliness. Check the paper for more results on the socially isolated group, but overall this lends more evidence to the need to address social isolation in order to mitigate the risk of dementia, and this is regardless of the genetic risk. So in that last paper, the authors found no direct relationship between self-reported loneliness and dementia. But of course, nearing any kind of scientific consensus requires a question to be examined from many different angles and to be taken into consideration with other variables. So here's another paper on loneliness and dementia risk for you, this time by first author Salinas and last author Seshadri from New York University and University of Texas Health Sciences Center. And the title of paper 13 is Association of Loneliness with 10-Year Dementia Risk and Early Markers of Vulnerability of Neurocognitive Decline. It was published in Neurology. Just over 2,300 participants from the Framingham study cohorts had loneliness assessed using the Center for Epidemiologic Studies Depression Scale. They were defined as being lonely if they reported feeling lonely over 3 days in the past week. Participants were assessed for incident dementia over a 10-year period, and the authors also looked at cognition and MRI brain volumes and white matter injury. They found that 14% of the study sample developed dementia, and 6% were categorized as lonely. These lonely individuals had a higher 10-year dementia risk after adjusting for age, sex, and education. This risk was particularly high for individuals younger than 80 and who did not carry the APOE4 allele. Loneliness was also associated with poorer executive function, lower total cerebral volume, and greater white matter injury. So, in the study sample tested here, and with the loneliness scale that was used by these authors, loneliness did come out as a risk factor for dementia, and as being directly associated with neurocognitive and structural markers related to AD and other dementias. If you are interested in the topic of social isolation, loneliness, and dementia risk, I encourage you to check out some of my older episodes or look at the bibliographies, and of course, stay tuned for more. So last in this social determinants section, we have a paper on occupation. This was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia by first author Rydström and last author Mangialasche from Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The title is Occupational Complexity and Cognition in the Finger Multidomain Intervention Trial, and paper 14 was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia. This study relates to what is thought to be a protective mechanism in preventing or slowing cognitive decline, and I mentioned it earlier this episode, that is cognitive reserve. So that's the idea that cognitively stimulating activities throughout life give your brain more of a buffer should Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative pathology come around later in life. As a result, proxies of cognitive stimulation, such as education or cognitively challenging jobs, might be associated with reduced risk of dementia. In this study, the authors examine whether lifetime exposure to occupational complexity is linked to late-life cognition in the context of a 2-year multi-domain Finnish geriatric intervention study to prevent cognitive impairment and disability. That is the FINGER study, which is a large study that I've covered in previous episodes. In this particular one, the authors retrospectively looked at the association between occupational complexity and cognition in just over 1,000 participants. They found that higher levels of occupational complexity were associated with better baseline cognition, but did not affect the outcomes of the multi-domain intervention on cognition. So this suggests that there is an association between being cognitively challenged at work and reduced risk of cognitive impairment later in life, but the authors conclude that the exploratory findings will need to be tested further in larger studies. And our last section for today is 5 papers that I have lumped under lifestyle and environmental factors. What I mean by lifestyle is somewhat modifiable risk factors, so things that we arguably have some control over, although that is debatable. And environmental factors for today's episode will focus on air pollution, so I'll get into that in a second here. But first up, a paper entitled Alcohol Consumption and Risk of Alzheimer's Disease, a Dose Response Meta-Analysis. This is by first author Qi and last author Feng from the Affiliated Hospital of Jilin Medical University in China. It was published in Geriatrics and Gerontology International, and this is paper number 15. The authors conducted a meta-analysis of research studies available on PubMed and Web of Science to determine the state of the literature on alcohol consumption and AD risk. They calculated the relative risk and 95% confidence intervals on the data from the 13 studies that met their inclusion criteria, and they conducted subgroup analyses based on the type of alcohol, ethnicity, study design, and sex. Based on this, they found that compared with non-drinkers, individuals who drank had a significantly lower risk of Alzheimer's, the relative risk being 0.68. This was driven primarily by drinking wine, as revealed by the subgroup analyses. Overall, this meta-analysis suggests that alcohol consumption could reduce AD risk, but caution should be used in interpreting these results, as other studies have found that excessive alcohol intake has the opposite effect. And alcohol consumption also has a tendency to affect sleep quality, and sleep quality or sleep troubles have been associated with Alzheimer's. In paper 16, the authors focus on subjective cognitive decline, which refers to, again, subjective memory or other cognitive complaints that could eventually progress to dementia, and they ask whether sleep duration plays a role in this. The first authors of this paper are Lin and Xu, though those are 2 first authors. The last author is Jia. This is coming from universities in China and was published in BMC Psychiatry. And paper 16 is entitled U-shaped association between sleep duration and subjective cognitive complaints in Chinese elderly, a cross-sectional study. So that study includes almost 700 Chinese adults aged 60 years and older who were assessed with the Subjective Cognitive Decline Questionnaire 9, which allows participants to report on their overall memory function and daily activity ability. The authors don't specify how sleep duration was measured, so check the paper for those details. As you heard in the title, they found a U-shaped association between sleep duration and the scores on the Subjective Cognitive Decline questionnaire, which remained even after adjusting for demographic characteristics, lifestyle behaviors, hypertension, and diabetes. So basically, both longer sleep duration, that is over 8 hours a night, and shorter duration, that is under 8 hours, were associated with more subjective cognitive complaints, and it suggests that managing sleep behaviors is important for protecting against cognitive decline and the progression to dementia. This next paper deals with a topic that probably hits home for a lot of us, namely the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on exercise. So personally, my initial response to mourning the loss of going to climbing gyms and dance studios consisted of excessive home workouts, but it soon became difficult to feel inspired by the same crunches and push-ups every day, and then my physical activity dwindled. The authors of paper 17 look at how this reduction in physical activity affected patients with Alzheimer's or mild cognitive impairment in their study entitled Reduction of Physical Activity During the COVID-19 Pandemic is Related to Increased Neuropsychiatric Symptoms in Memory Clinic Patients. This was published in Clinical Medicine by first author Wurm, last author Strugman at the Medical University of Vienna. So as you can imagine, people living in long-term care facilities and memory clinics felt the effects of the pandemic more than the average citizen, particularly with the impact on care and routines that were being disrupted. In this study, the authors investigated the effects of the lockdown on memory clinic patients, particularly on how it impacted their physical activity and subsequent cognitive function. In 72 participants who suffered from AD or MCI, the authors examined indicators of lockdown intensity. They interviewed both the patients and caregivers and conducted neuropsychological tests. They report that the patients experienced a median of 8 weeks of isolation and a significant reduction in social contacts, that is from 5 visitors to 2 a week. We heard about the detrimental effects of social isolation earlier, but on top of that, physical activity was reduced during the lockdown, which was significantly correlated with higher scores on the neuropsychiatric inventory score. In other words, the reduced physical activity was associated with increased neuropsychiatric symptoms, and a fear of the pandemic also impacted the patient's health. These findings speak towards the importance of considering how the lockdown affects this vulnerable population and what measures could be taken to lessen the negative impact. So that brings us to our last two papers, and we're looking at environmental risk factors to round off our episode, namely air pollution. This is a fairly established risk factor for Alzheimer's and comes up time and time again in my episodes. We'll start with a case study today with paper 18, which was published in Environmental Science and Technology by two authors, the first being Calderon Garcidueñas and the last being Ayala. This is coming from universities in the U.S. and in Mexico. And the title of paper 18 is Air Pollution, Ultrafine Particles, and Your Brain. Are Combustion Nanoparticle Emissions and Engineered Nanoparticles Causing Preventable Fatal Neurodegenerative Diseases and Common Neuropsychiatric Outcomes? So usually we don't really cover reviews in these episodes, but this is kind of in the line between being a case study and a review, so here we go. And when we talk about air pollution and health research, just so you know, the term fine particulate matter comes up a lot. These are very small particles that enter our body through respiratory or other pathways and end up in our bloodstream. Particulate matter that is smaller than 2.5 microns, also known as PM2.5, is particularly associated with AD risk. The authors report on residents in the metropolitan Mexico City who are regularly exposed to PM2.5 above the U.S. annual average standards of 12 micrograms per meter cubed. Children and young adults in the city have greater cognitive and olfaction deficits, problems with gait and equilibrium, sleep disorders, and evidence of neurodegenerative disease pathology in their brains. In this paper, the authors discuss all of this rather compelling evidence of increased AD and dementia risk in this young population and the implications for both policy interventions and the future of this highly polluted city. And we're in the UK for this last paper, although the research itself comes primarily from authors at the University of Arizona. First author Para and last author Furlong examined the associations between air pollution and three types of dementia, and whether the risk is modified by the APOE4 genotype. So paper 19 is Exposure to Air Pollution and Risk of Incident Dementia in the UK Biobank, and it was published in Environmental Research. The authors studied over 187,000 participants enrolled in the UK Biobank study to assess the risk of AD, frontotemporal dementia, and vascular dementia, and how it relates to exposure to various air pollutants. So that includes PM2.5 as well as nitrogen dioxide. Participants were over 60 years of age and had no dementia diagnosis at baseline, and they were followed for a mean of 7 years. The authors report a consistent association between PM2.5 with greater risk of all-cause dementia, that is to say, in all three subtypes together. Nitrogen dioxide was associated with increased risk of incident dementia, as well as AD and vascular dementia specifically. There was no modification by the APOE4 genotype, suggesting that greater exposure to PM2.5 and nitrogen dioxide levels increased dementia risk regardless of genetic risk. That brings us to the end of our episode, but I would like to mention that there are about 10 papers that I was unable to cover this month. It's been very busy with my postdoc research. I was organizing a live performance of an arts-based knowledge translation piece on Parkinson's disease, and so I was unable to summarize the rest of this episode. So what you're missing out on is a couple papers on traumatic brain injury, a bit of cardiovascular and pulmonary function, fatty liver disease, a little bit of a random smattering of papers, which you can still find in the accompanying bibliography. With that, I would like to thank you for listening. I hope you found this episode accessible and useful, and hopefully a little interesting as well. We are releasing episodes 3 times a week on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, so stay tuned for more. And of course, before I sign off, I'd like to thank and give a huge shout out to the whole Aminder team who works tirelessly on these episodes. For today's episode, I would particularly like to thank the sorting team. I'd like to thank Alyssa for reviewing my script today, and Michelle for editing the audio. Anusha reviewed that editing, and Laura made the bibliography. And with that, dear listener, I wish you a wonderful continuation to your day. I'll be back at you next month with more episodes. Talk to you then.